It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Lots to offer this hour in our set of quick conversations to end the week to get to some of the news that we didn't get to otherwise during our talk shows this week. Later in the hour, this is a real treat. Jason Lezak, remember that name? Maybe not. Four-time Olympian, a gold medalist for the U.S. swimming team. He's coming to Cedar Rapids. Conversation with him later in the hour. Also, why Iowa has some of the weakest animal protection laws in the country. That's still to come this hour as well. First of all, though, 1 week away from Inauguration Day in Washington, Iowa Public Radio will bring you live coverage next Friday, a week from today, when Donald Trump will be sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. But let's spend a few minutes checking in with the political scene here in Iowa. Now, first of all, with the first week of the 2017 Iowa legislative session nearly behind us, let's check in with Iowa Public Radio's legislative correspondent, Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Ben.
So, Governor Branstad, slated by Donald Trump to be the next U.S. ambassador to China, his Lieutenant Governor Kim Reynolds in line to take over the governorship when he does, becoming Iowa's first female governor. An interesting story you covered this week connected with that a Democratic state lawmaker, state senator, wants there to be a change in the confirmation process or how this would come about?
Well, he would institute a confirmation process where there isn't one now. I don't have any indication that yet anyway that Republicans will take up this bill, but it's an interesting idea. Currently, top positions in state government, such as Board of Regents and department heads, they don't face the voters, so they have to undergo a two-thirds majority vote in the Senate to be confirmed. Most people survive that. Some people don't survive that. But at any rate, the person that Kim Reynolds chooses for lieutenant governor without this bill would assume office and then be in line to even assume the governorship without either having faced the voters or a confirmation vote of any kind. Mm. And it turns out that there are, I believe it's 8 states that do require confirmation in a case like this. And so that's what this bill would do. However, it wouldn't be a two-thirds confirmation vote. It would be a simple majority in both the House and Senate. So there's no way, with the Republicans in charge, there's no way that Kim Reynolds' choice could be voted down. But it could give Democrats a chance to stand up and maybe say some negative things about them. And that's why it doesn't seem likely to me that Republicans are going to go along with this.
Very interesting. Planned Parenthood, let's talk about that. That's been talked about a lot by Republican lawmakers over the years, and now they have control of both chambers in the Iowa legislature. Defunding Planned Parenthood is on the agenda. Remind us, why do Republicans want to defund Planned Parenthood?
Because they oppose abortion, and Planned Parenthood currently receives federal Medicaid dollars, a federal state match of Medicaid dollars. And for years, Republicans in the House have tried through budget bills, had tried to stop that and rewrite the description of who gets this money in such a way that none of the money would go to Planned Parenthood. Need to make clear the money does not fund abortions, but it does go to Planned Parenthood, which it's for family planning services at Planned Parenthood. And Planned Parenthood does provide abortion. So that's, they just want to cut off funding for Planned Parenthood, simple enough. And I don't see anything that's going to stop this, although Planned Parenthood is gearing up for a fight over it.
Mm-hmm. They don't want to lose out on this federal money going here. So are they going to have something in place to make up for this?
They're going to take, there's another source of federal money called a block grant that goes for a number of social services, including family planning. So the governor's plan is to take some of that money to replace the Medicaid dollars we're going to be using, and then give that to other health services which provide family planning but do not offer abortions. There's, you know, a couple of hundred of those, and they would continue to get their funding, but Planned Parenthood would not. And this money, this federal block grant, now it goes for things like adoption services, I believe, foster care, various social services. And so the critics of this are saying you're actually going to be taking money that's needed for these other things and giving it to these other agencies when we could be using $3 million of federal Medicaid money.
Mm-hmm. Joyce Russell, a couple minutes to talk about a couple of other items before the legislature. Plans for firearms legislation already on the table. What changes suggested there?
Well, Senator Bill Dix, the new Republican majority leader in the Senate, said that this was a constitutional amendment to the Iowa Constitution clarifying the right to bear arms. So sure enough, that got introduced this week. And the U.S. Constitution already has that. This would add it to the Iowa Constitution, and it would actually go further than the federal Constitution right to bear arms does. And it appears that it would just get rid of all firearms, you know, registration, licensing, all of that.
Background checks?
Well, as far as background checks are part of getting a firearms license, a license to carry, the license to carry would no longer be required. Now, there are some federal, there would still be some federal mm-hmm. background check requirements.
Okay, so at the state level, erasing all of that or making it, prohibiting it.
Yeah.
At least.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, a constitutional amendment doesn't happen overnight. It would have to go to a pass both the House and Senate in two successive general assemblies, and then it goes to a vote of the people. So this would be down the line. But I don't know, with the Republican majority, it looks like it's probably going to pass.
Mm-hmm. Joyce, thanks for the update. Monday, we won't be together because we have a holiday, the Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday. So we'll talk to you the Monday afterwards with our regular legislative update. Joyce Russell, we'll be watching the issues that you've updated us on. Iowa Public Radio's legislative correspondent, Joyce Russell. Thanks, Joyce.
Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, let's continue with state politics and the budget deficit Governor Branstad mentioned this week in his Condition of the State address. He proposed about $110 million in cuts. That's to make up for the lower than projected revenues taken in by the state. And if those cuts get the green light from the Iowa House and Senate budget committees, it is higher education that will take the biggest hit, at least according to the governor's proposal. Joining us now to talk about the proposed cuts, Jeff Carice-Carlson, higher education reporter with the Iowa City Press-Citizen and the Des Moines Register. Always good to have you in to do a little bit of explaining, Jeff, about higher education. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Ben.
So talk about these cuts. $34 million. How do we judge how significant that is for higher education in the state?
Well, it's $34 million, which divides up to about $25.5 million for the Regents universities and then $8.7 million for the community colleges. And it's important to note that that's over the next 5.5 months that they have to find those savings. That's for this fiscal year. And as you said, that those proposals still need to be approved by the legislature. They could be a little bit less. They could be a little more. No one knows what's going to happen with that. But that is a lot of work for all of those higher educational institutions to try to find that amount of cuts in mm-hmm. the next 5.5 months.
What's been the reaction from lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers?
Democratic lawmakers, especially in the Senate, have blasted basically this proposal and said that it's too much to ask for to put on higher education. Many Democratic leaders have called for the state to use some of its rainy day funds. It has $738 million, I think it is, in reserve funds. And they're saying that that money is supposed to be an economic cushion for times that the revenue isn't quite there. Other people say, well, it's not raining. I guess the response I've heard is, well, it's misting a little. And we should turn to that as opposed to putting such severe cuts on the institutions that are educating the next generation of Iowans.
The Board of Regents supervises the public universities.
Yes.
Their reaction has been
Very politic, very polite, very, we understand the difficulties that the state is finding itself in. We are going to work with them. If those cuts come, we're going to work to implement it so that they do not impact students negatively. The community colleges have said the same thing. Everyone's waiting for the exact numbers so that they can figure out exactly where they're going to find that savings.
Is it hard to see that this wouldn't raise tuition, or is tuition locked in for a certain amount of time?
The Board of Regents have said that tuition is locked in for this fall, the 2017-18 school year. They've said that publicly.
The fall and the spring.
The fall. I think they said the fall. I'm not sure if they said as much for the spring, but they did say that people would know for the fall. In the past, they have done a mid-year cut within recent or just a few years ago as well. I wouldn't take that off the table, although people can expect what the fall tuition is. That seems pretty set based on what they've said.
Mm-hmm. What other options do the universities have and the community colleges have? They can look for savings, I guess, but
they can look for savings. They can let a lot of positions go dark. It doesn't sound like anyone is imposing across-the-board cuts, that these will be selective cuts. And I haven't heard anything yet about what's happening at the universities. I did talk with Rob Denson, who is the president of DMAC, and he says that they've known some things were possible. They've not filled some positions that they're and I would imagine the universities have done the same thing.
They've been bracing for that,
even if they haven't publicly said what the options are.
Specifically about the community colleges, this is really an impact for Iowa's workforce, isn't it? Because on this program, we've talked about the shortage of workers in, for instance, skilled trades in Iowa, and that would have a direct impact.
They do the lion's share of training and educating for those type of mid-level workers as well, as they are happy to point out anytime that you bring up this topic. They're also stressing that they hope lawmakers recognize that and that they haven't been getting huge increases in previous years. If anything, it's been below the cost of the higher education inflation. So this hits them pretty hard.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of education, K through 12, saved from these cuts.
Saved from these cuts, which by saving them, by taking Medicaid off the table, by taking property tax credits off the table, there weren't a lot of other big pots to pull from if you're going to look for $110 million in cuts, other than higher education being the biggest one.
Mm-hmm. How are we to interpret these suggested cuts by the governor? Is this a trial balloon, or is this something the legislature and the people of I will just have to work with here?
I don't really know how to answer that. There's a lot of questions about what the governor's views are right now as he's preparing for his own transition,
right,
and when that transition will happen. I wouldn't say it's a trial balloon as much as, again, just the necessity is if you're going to cut that much money and you're not going to take some of, and you're going to take basically as much as 3/4 of the budget off the table, there's only so many places that you can cut.
Okay. One more thing, Jeff, please, before we let you go here. A huge donation to Iowa State University announced this week. Kind of a mystery donation, anonymous donors, in a certain interesting way in which the donation came.
As far as I know, that there's only one other example of this type of donation. Someone has donated a majority stake in an education company. That means all the stock and ownership. And so Iowa State University is basically taking ownership of a Massachusetts-based education company called Curriculum Associates. Within 5 years, they'll probably sell all of those shares. They're not looking for, like, it's not changing the management. They're not telling anyone how to run the company. But when they get that much money and they finally sell, based on what the company's worth today, who knows what it'll be when it goes to market, mm-hmm, those shares are going to be worth $120 million, of which they then have to give what's now $28 million to the Boston Foundation. I don't exactly understand all the mechanics of how this works, but it's the first time that we've seen something like this in Iowa, and it's one of the few times that we've seen something like this nationwide.
Mm-hmm. Has ISU said anything about how that huge pot of money would be used?
They are, yes. It is going to be focused on the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences. It's going to be made for a number of new faculty lines, a number of new scholarships, targeted large. Some of the most recent ones, or the initial ones, will be focused on the School of Journalism and Communication, as well as on the theater department.
Mm-hmm. So, when anonymous donors, we don't know.
It's an awkward situation. There's really only one person that it could be. All you have to do is Google Curriculum Associates and Iowa State University, and you will see the name of the person that's there, who's a longstanding alumni of the university and is a former CEO and chairman of
keeping us in suspense. You're not going to say it.
We have printed the name that we think is the most likely donor. Frank Ferguson is his name. He has confirmed that with the Cedar Rapids Gazette as well. And he wants to stay out of the limelight with this. It's an awkward thing because it's hard to have anything anonymous in an internet age.
Okay. Jeff Carice Carlson, the higher education reporter with the Iowa City Press Citizen and the Des Moines Register. Thank you for keeping us up to date on the likely effects of the budget cuts headed for higher education in Iowa. And this last little tidbit, the interesting anonymous donation, huge, perhaps record-setting donation for Iowa City.
They use the word transformative all the time.
Transformative. All right. Jeff, thanks for coming in.
All right. Thank you, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Every year, the Animal Legal Defense Fund releases a report that ranks the animal protection laws of all 50 states. Its newest report has just come out. Our neighbor, Illinois, takes first place, followed by Oregon, Maine, California. So where's Iowa in this ranking of states' animal protection laws? Also near the top? Not even close. In fact, according to this report, Iowa has some of the weakest animal protection laws. Iowa is ranked 49th out of 50. Joining us now by phone from Portland, Laura Dunn, Interim Director and Senior Staff Attorney of the Criminal Justice Program at the Animal Legal Defense Fund. Hi, Laura.
Hi, and thank you for having me.
What were the criteria for this report?
So every year, the Animal Legal Defense Fund publishes our rankings report. We look at a wide variety of legislation relating to animal protection. We look at 15 distinct categories, and those range from penalties for abuse and neglect of animals to whether a court can order that animals be forfeited upon conviction to keep them out of the hands of known dangerous offenders. So we really look at a variety of different legislation, and then we rank the states among each other.
Mm-hmm. So can you point to, in Iowa's case, what made us rank so low?
So first and foremost, in Iowa, a prosecutor cannot charge animal cruelty as a felony in all circumstances. So in the cases of neglect, for example, when an animal has been starved, has been left without food, water, sometimes veterinary care, that offense cannot be charged as a felony. And we at the Animal Legal Defense Fund see, unfortunately, really egregious cases of animal neglect. Very often, these are cases where animals are suffering the most amount of harm because they're languishing for months, sometimes for years in these conditions. So we would love to see Iowa be able to impose a felony penalty for animal neglect.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts? We said Illinois was number one, right at the other end of the spectrum with the strongest animal protection laws in the country, according to your new report. So, of course, Iowa doesn't have the Chicagoland area, but they are both ag states otherwise. Does being an ag state have anything to do with Iowa's low ranking?
We really see that throughout the country, regardless of the state, there are folks who are passionate about animal protection, who get involved in passing better legislation for animal victims. So Illinois is holding strong at the top for a variety of reasons. One of those is protective orders include animals. So we're talking about domestic violence situations where human victims are fleeing from their situations of abuse. In Illinois, a court, by law, can order that animals, that pets, also be included in those protective orders. And we would like to see Iowa pass similar type of strong legislation in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
Illinois as well requires by law that after an offender has been convicted, that person not be able to own animals for a certain period of time, depending on the nature and the severity of the offense. So in Iowa, again, that is not required by law, and we would like to see Iowa make that change to help protect future animal victims.
Do you at the Animal Legal Defense Fund have any thoughts or guidelines, ways from get from, say, Illinois, from Iowa's position, almost dead last, with the weakest animal protection laws up to more where Illinois is?
Absolutely. So you can go on our website, aldf.org, and look through our rankings report. We really provide a breakdown for the best five states where Illinois falls, as well as the bottom five states where Iowa is sitting now. And you can look at ways in which Iowa and other states at the bottom can improve very specific laws. Also on our website at ALVF.org, we have model laws for animal protection as kind of a guideline for improvement within your state.
Mm-hmm. Laura, the goal of having strong animal protection laws is certainly self-evident for many listening as a worthy goal. But for those who need convincing, why are these strong laws important?
Well, the FBI recently recognized that these are really heinous crimes and that these are important not only for the protection of animal victims, but also human victims. The FBI recently started tracking animal crimes in its own separate category within their tracking system. And that really signaled to everyone across the nation that these crimes do matter. There is a very strong documented link between crimes against animal victims and crimes against human victims. We know that statistically, those who harm animals are five times more likely to go on to harm human victims in the future. And so animal cruelty is a community safety issue. So we at the Animal Legal Defense Fund think that that is extremely important in its own right.
Laura, when we look at this issue over time, over decades, are we doing better here in terms of strengthening animal protection laws?
Absolutely. So since we began tracking animal protection laws in our rankings report 11 years ago, the Animal Legal Defense Fund has seen a tremendous change and improvement across the board, across all 50 states. So for example, 10 jurisdictions now have for the first time felony penalties for extreme animal cruelty and torture. Many jurisdictions for the first time have added sexual assault as a specific crime against animals. So really, we're very encouraged to see that the trend each year is going in the right direction toward more protection for animals. Again, it's still very important for those who care about animal protection and these issues to get involved and make your voices heard. Contact your local representative.
Interim Director and Senior Staff Attorney of the Criminal Justice Program at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, Laura Dunn, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up after a short break, budget warnings from Iowa's Chief Justice. New research tells us that for some, the usually harmless figure of speech, "I could just kill you," may be a red flag. And a conversation with U.S. swimming gold medalist Jason Lezak, who's coming to Iowa this weekend. I'm Ben Kiefer. Your Friday News Buzz continues after this short break. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Still to come, "I could just kill you." We know that's a figure of speech. I've said it. You've probably said it in a moment of frustration or anger. It's a harmless remark without real meaning. Or is it? In a few minutes, we'll find out about new research from Iowa State University that indicates a small percentage of the population thinks that phrase is more than just a harmless phrase. Let's say it that way. Also coming up, Jason Lezak, four-time Olympian. He's a gold medalist, Olympian swimmer. I'll talk with him in just a moment. He's going to be in Cedar Rapids on the weekend. But first, remember that state budget shortfall mentioned in the first half of the program likely to impact Iowa's courts as well. The condition of the judiciary address was also delivered this week, and Chief Justice Mark Cady warned lawmakers about a lack of funding for the state judicial branch, which is already beginning to emerge. Joining us briefly to discuss this, Sarah Bowden, Iowa Public Radio reporter. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Ben.
Tell us about the funding problem with Iowa's courts as seen by the Chief Justice.
Yes, this year the governor asked the judicial branch to cut $7.7 million from its annual budget. And then next year, the Chief Justice had requested $7.7 million more than what the governor is proposing for the judicial branch to receive. And the Chief Justice says this will impact Iowans' access to justice.
Access to our court system is in jeopardy when we don't have the people in place to provide the services that Iowans come to our courthouse to attain. And so yeah, this is an access to justice issue. This is a, as I said today, there is just so much more that we can do, and that's what our objective should be as a state, to do more for Iowans. And when we do find an opportunities to do more, the benefits come back and the gain comes back in a very significant way.
Mark Cady, Chief Justice of the Iowa Supreme Court. Sarah, he also had some warnings, words to say of warning about something that we've talked about on this program a number of times, Iowa's specialty courts. Remind us what those are.
Yeah, specialty courts serve specific populations, so juveniles, veterans, people with mental health or substance abuse issues, family courts. So what it does, it takes sort of a holistic approach to these specific populations that encounter specific problems, and then tries to, well, it'll use prison as a sort of leverage to get people to address underlying issues that cause them to engage in criminal activity.
Mm-hmm. And Chief Justice Cady had something, his plea in that direction as well. Let's listen to it.
These courts are keeping individuals who are committed to overcoming the cause of their criminal acts from entering our prison. Instead of going to prison, graduates leave these courts with a job, a support system, and a far greater opportunity to succeed in life.
So Sarah Bowden, dire warnings from the Chief Justice, Mark Cady. I guess we'll find out with our coverage of the governor and the legislature in the weeks to come whether those warnings will be heeded. But in practical detail, he's saying these will have a big impact on our judicial branch.
He is. He's saying that there could be a cut in court hours, perhaps fewer juvenile officers, perhaps an elimination of specialty courts. Right now, there are 47 specialty courts in the state, and he's saying that those could go away, and he's saying that they're working. So, yeah, it's pretty dire what the Chief Justice is saying.
Okay, thanks for the update on the condition of the judiciary. That address delivered this week by Chief Justice Mark Cady. Sarah Bowden with Iowa Public Radio, thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. I could just kill you. A figure of speech many of us have uttered in moments of frustration or anger. A harmless remark without any real meaning. Or is it? According to new research at Iowa State University, for a small percentage of the population, the phrase, I could kill you, is not so meaningless. Matt DeLisi joins us now, professor of sociology and faculty affiliate of the Center for the Study of Violence at Iowa State University. Matt, welcome back to our program.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So this is something that you and your colleagues wrote about in a paper published in an upcoming issue of the American Journal of Criminal Justice. What did you find?
So for homicidal ideation, as you mentioned, it's often just a figure of speech, and many people, perhaps everyone, has uttered it. But for others, homicidal ideation is something that's much more sinister and much more pervasive. And so using a population of federal correctional clients, we looked at whether there was any evidence of this in client psychiatric history. And we found that it's relatively rare, but among those who have it, it's relatively problematic. So about 88% of the clients in the population had no evidence of it. About 3% had some indications of it, and about 9% of them had definite evidence of it. Mm-hmm. And what we found is that those who had definite evidence of it were much more severe offenders, had much more extensive criminal careers, were much more violent across dimensions, not just for homicide, and had much more severe psychopathology with conditions like antisocial personality disorder.
Okay, I'm going to unravel that a little bit. Homicidal ideation is, as the name would indicate, having an idea that you would like to commit homicide.
Correct. So it's interesting. In prior survey research, usually done on university samples, has found that homicidal ideation is actually somewhat prevalent. 50, 60, 70% of individuals will indicate that they had experienced some homicidal ideation in their life. Overwhelmingly, it's associated with having a dispute or an argument or a fight. And there's also some interesting gender differences. So for women, it's usually linked to relationships and family dynamics and children. Males are much more likely to have homicidal ideation, not only in family relationships, but also against acquaintances and strangers. But fortunately, for most normal people, quote-unquote, the ideation is very short-lived, and it's really not clinically meaningful in most times. As soon as the argument has subsided, as soon as they've cooled off, there's really no issue.
So is it the majority of the population that does have homicidal thoughts or fantasies at one time or another?
The majority of the population would, but they would be very transitory.
Okay, it's a very, very brief, and then your brain cools down, and then you're good.
Correct. But for less than 10%, and in our study about 12%, again, using an offender sample, there was evidence of it. And for these individuals, the homicidal ideation is much more enduring. It's pervasive. They experience it not only in adulthood, but it often tracks back into early childhood. And for them, it's part of a whole emotional life that's very angry, a lot of hostility, and it's problematic given how antisocial they are that these are the individuals who could decide that homicide is something they would want to do.
Mm-hmm. So what are the implications here? It seems, you know, finding the people who has just this moment of I could just kill you feeling, and then the enduring ones, how do you separate that? And is the implication here that we could predict, forecast criminal behavior?
Not necessarily. There's sort of two ways I would answer that. One implication is that if you know you have a correctional client who has definite evidence of homicidal ideation, one, what we found is that they're going to have a much more extensive criminal history. They're going to be more violent as well. And so that would be the type of individual who you would want to be more careful with in terms of your supervision. So for instance, you know, if you're doing a home visit on a probationer or a parolee, you would want to make sure that there were multiple probation officers who went on the home visit to help to guarantee the safety of everyone involved. So it's just a piece of information that's useful for practitioners mm-hmm. to know who it is that they're dealing with. It'd be similar to knowing if someone is a psychopathic or if someone has intermittent explosive disorder or antisocial personality disorder. There's a number of conditions that are severe risk factors for antisocial behavior. But another interesting thing about this in my sort of prior work in the criminal justice system is very severe offenders, particularly those who perpetrate homicides or multiple homicides, many of them will experience and articulate homicidal statements even in very early childhood, even as early as age 3 and 4 and 5. And for them, acts such as animal abuse, which is very common among very violent offenders, it kind of puts a new context or new spin on that. So the animal abuse might just be sort of mere severe delinquency, but it also might be an outgrowth of these homicidal ideations that they're experiencing and they're practicing out on animals before becoming adults or adolescents and perpetrating it on humans.
Mm-hmm. So parents listening might be alarmed to hear you say this. So a lot of kids say that. I could just kill you, or I could kill you early in life. Again, do we know in early in life how to distinguish that? You say if there's cruelty to animals, that could be another factor that would indicate we may want to pay a lot of attention.
If it was during adolescence, during the tumultuous adolescence, it would be less clinically meaningful than if you had a child who was articulating homicidal statements in the preschool period or as a very young elementary school student. So the timing of it is very important. Onset usually works is that the earlier something emerges, the more severe it is, and that's certainly the case with criminal characteristics. But no, I would put it into context in terms of, again, going back to what we originally talked about, if you're having a dispute with your teenager or you're disciplining them and there's kinds of statements or say, oh, I could kill you, it's probably not something that has a lot of veracity. It's probably just letting off steam. Mm-hmm. And again, that's in the general population. The other thing to think about is the data that we were using are federal correctional clients. So these are individuals who've been to federal prison and are now on community supervised release.
Mm-hmm. Does researchers in this area tell us anything about whether these, you call it homicidal ideation, the thought of killing another person, whether that's innate or learned?
It would be both. Our research doesn't really speak to that, but there would be certainly evidence that certain kinds of trauma exposure would likely increase the likelihood of it, certain types of abuse. Interestingly, you know, it's often co-occurs with suicidal ideation, and in our data, there was a very weak and non-significant correlation between homicidal ideation and suicidal ideation. Sometimes in offenders, you see both of those very strongly. So, for instance, mass murderers, so people who kill a number of individuals at one discrete time and place, often commit suicide after those after the violence is done, and many of them are acutely homicidal and suicidal. Serial murderers, on the other hand, rarely commit suicide, and because they experience very little suicidal ideation relative to the homicidal ideation that they experience.
Mm-hmm. Does this say anything to the epidemic of mass killings? Have any bearing on the epidemic of mass killings we've had in this country over the past few years?
Good question. The interesting thing is homicidal ideation is almost very little of it has been studied in criminology, and in part because it's something that researchers usually don't have measures of or access to files that would contain these kinds of data. So one of the things that we're hoping is that if there are additional criminologists around the country, around the world, who have clinical data where there are measures of homicidal ideation, to start plugging them into some other models to see, are they associated with severe offending careers? Are they associated with different kinds of violence? And if so, if we start to really replicate this finding, is it something that we can try and target early on to try and reduce?
Okay. Matt DeLisi, professor of sociology and also with the Center for the Study of Violence at Iowa State University. Matt and his colleagues publishing a paper in an upcoming issue of the American Journal of Criminal Justice. Thanks very much for sharing your research, Matt.
Thank you very much.
It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Sunday, January 15th, two Olympic gold medalists from Team USA Olympic Swimming will coach young swimmers at the Helen G. Nassif YMCA in Cedar Rapids during the Mutual of Omaha Breakout Swim Clinic. Joining us now, one of those Olympic swimmers, Jason Lezak, four-time Olympian, gold medalist, world record holder. Jason, welcome to our program.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
What will you be teaching the young swimmers during this three-hour clinic?
Yeah, it's going to be great. We're going to work with these kids, and we're going to get in the water with them. So we're going to be doing a lot of different things, and mainly in the water, teaching them some of the things that we learned to help us get to the highest level, obviously making the Olympics. A lot of these kids will have that dream, and some of them won't. Some of them are just swimming for fun, but it's great to be able to share some things with them and then get out of the water. We'll give them some stories. We'll tell them about the work ethic and all the different things we had to do outside of the water to achieve that success as well. And then obviously what the kids love is to see that gold medal. So we bring our gold medals with us, and we do the autographs, and we take pictures with them, and that's one of the highlights for them.
So they get a touch and hold the Olympic medal you won?
Yeah, some of them are afraid to touch it or hold it or wear it, and others are grabbing it from you and putting it right on. So you get a different group of people, but it's great, and they have a fun time with it. You even find those ones that don't want to take a picture, but their parents force them because they know one day they'll want to see it.
Well, let's go back to one of your great Olympic moments. It was a great moment for the nation, the Beijing Olympics. You swam faster than anyone in history in the last leg of the 4x100 relay in the Beijing Olympics. At 32, you were the oldest man on the U.S. swim team. You anchored. We have a little bit of audio here to listen. It's exciting to listen to it years later. You anchored the 4x100. The men's 400-meter freestyle relay. This is a come-from-behind victory, stealing gold from the French, and many experts in sports say this is one of the greatest upsets in Olympic history. Let's have a listen to the last few seconds of this at the Beijing Olympics. Listen to the commentator. You'll be taken right back there. I remember watching this live.
Olympian world record is absolutely going to be shattered here. The United States try to hang out a second. They should get the silver medal. Australia is in bronze territory right now, but Lezak is closing a little bit on Bernard. Can the veteran chase him down and pull off a shocker here? Well, there's no doubt that he's tightening up. Bernard is losing some ground. Here comes Lezak. Unbelievable at the end. He's done it. The U.S. has done it. He did it. And he did it. He did it.
Oh, Jason Lezak tingles up and down my spine, and I'm just reliving it the way I did watching it, as so many in the nation did. What was it like to do that?
You know what? Going into that race, we were the underdogs. Nobody really considered us the favorites to win that. And when I was going up against the world record holder, obviously the odds were not in my favor. But, a lot of people don't know, we were supposed to win the previous two Olympics where we came in second and third in those. And we had never lost that relay in Olympic history before 2000. So for me, it was about bringing home the gold for USA. And I didn't care who I was going up to. And, it was a great honor to be on the USA team and to out-touch the French team, celebrate with my teammates, and feel like you did your country proud and get on that podium was an unreal experience.
I'm sure it was. So you're going to be teaching these young swimmers in Cedar Rapids this weekend. What are some of the biggest challenges facing a young swimmer who aspires to possibly rise to the Olympic level?
You know, a lot of them expect it to happen overnight. And, you know, my story is great because I didn't make my first Olympics until 24. So I like to tell these kids, you know, look, they're going to have a lot of ups and downs on along the way. And there's going to be times where they feel like quitting. They're not going to accomplish what they want to. But, you know, they need to go back to the drawing board, reset their goals, figure out how to do better next time. And it's a long process. And what's really important is, I lost sight of this at one point, is having fun. Sports are supposed to be fun. So win or lose, you know, you do your best, but you've got to enjoy what you're doing, and that's the only way.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a time in your training when you had to find a way to regain that sense of fun? It had gone somehow?
Oh, for sure. Definitely. Especially when I was young. You know, I was one of the top in the country for a while, and then I kind of disappeared from the scene, and it wasn't fun for me anymore. And once I got back into high school, I realized that's what I was missing out on. And it's sometimes hard for kids to realize what they're missing out on and why they aren't achieving certain things. But all I really had to do was see some of my friends having so much more fun than me. And as soon as I changed my attitude, once you start enjoying something, you're more willing to put in the work and do the things that it takes to be the best.
How early, Jason, can world-class swimmers be spotted?
You know what? I mean, obviously you can see kids that have talent, but not every person in every sport that has talent comes through with that talent. And there's those kids that work 10 times harder than somebody that has talent. So you gotta have a little bit of both. And, you know, there's that one thing that you can tell is when you get down to racing, you know, certain people have that drive and they have that racing spirit. And I think that's really important. You have to want to win. You can't show up to a race and just give it 100%. There's got to be more than 100%. You got to have that drive inside.
Mm-hmm. So now you're in your 40s. You're retired from competitive swimming?
Thanks for reminding me. Yeah.
you miss it.
It's okay. I feel great. I'm 41 now, and I retired back in 2012. So for the last 5 years, I've had the opportunity to travel the world and travel the country and do exactly what I'm going to be coming out to you guys for. And it's a lot of fun for me. I get a chance to give back to the kids and inspire some of these younger swimmers to, you know, reach those dreams and go for their goals.
Uh-huh. How often do you swim to relax, just for enjoyment?
So I took a break, but I try to get in the water about once a week and swim with a friend of mine. Actually, this week I made it twice, so I'm feeling pretty good about myself. And these aren't hard workouts. They're just having a little fun with my friend to get in the water, stay in somewhat of shape. Because, you know, I get in the water with these kids, and I demonstrate the drills, and I even race the kids, too. So they got a little bit of racing to look forward to. But since you said I'm old and retired, I usually only have one or two races in me, and good thing Kelsey's still training. She can get in there and race about 10 times, not a problem.
Kelsey is the other Olympian who will be joining you in Cedar Rapids on the weekend. I wanted to ask a big trend among water and swimming enthusiasts, open water swimming, very much a trend over the past few years, swimming not in pools but in lakes, in the ocean. Is that something you like?
You know what? So I grew up here in California, and the water temperature is fairly warm in the ocean, but it's not 80 degrees, which I really like at the pool. So I was never a fan of swimming in that, as I would call it, cold ocean water. And also, I'm a sprinter, so those ocean water swims are long, and I like that short distance. So never got into the ocean water swimming too much. I did some of it, but more for fun and enjoyment. And now I try to stay away from cold water as much as possible.
All right. Jason Lezak, thank you very much for joining us. Four-time Olympian, gold medalist, world record holder, Jason Lezak. He'll be one of two Olympic gold medalists from Team USA Olympic Swimming, coaching young swimmers at the Helen G. Nassif YMCA in Cedar Rapids during the Mutual of Omaha Breakout Swim Clinic. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
All right. Thanks for having me. I look forward to coming out this weekend.
And that's it for this News Buzz edition of our program. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Chelsea Hoy. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Have a great holiday weekend. Thank you.